KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. For a year, novelist Barbara Kingsolver and her family ate a locally produced diet. We'll find out all about that food sabbatical and why it means so much environmentally to Stephen Hoppe and Barbara Kingsolver and to us. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Award-winning novelist and National Humanities Medal recipient Barbara Kingsolver, her husband Stephen Hoppe, and their two daughters spent a year planting and harvesting, raising poultry and other animals, eating seasonally, and generally getting their hands dirty. Both Barbara Kingsolver and her husband are trained as biologists. In fact, Stephen Hoppe is an acoustic biologist who can tell you a lot about bird songs, but what we're going to talk about this hour largely is food. Daughter Camille was involved in this. She's also studying biology along with anatomy and dance at Duke. And together, what they did was essentially ate locally for a year and wrote about it in the recently published book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. We welcome Barbara Kingsolver and Stephen Hoppe. Good to have you both here.
Hi, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
I was just saying to Barbara, remembering that we went through a disaster when I was doing Talk of the Nation. Everything went wrong, technically, that could have gone wrong. It was a broadcaster's nightmare. But I was also reminiscing about one of the times I had her on many years ago, and she was saying Americans generally don't know where their food comes from. They don't know the labor that goes into the food that appears on their grocery shelves and so forth. And in fact, you kind of mentioned in passing here, I want to talk about what you did, of course, when you moved to Virginia and this year that you spent, but you kind of mentioned in passing here that maybe there should be courses in agricultural awareness, and you wouldn't mind if they were compulsory, I got the feeling, for students in schools, public schools, I mean.
Well, it's interesting that in the last couple of generations, we have come to think of farming as something other people can do for us far, far away. The baby boom psyche embraces a powerful feeling that dirt and labor are something we should get away from. And yet, if it's good enough for somebody else to know farming, why isn't it good enough for somebody to know the Bill of Rights? Turning our backs on food systems has created a lot of problems that are suddenly really kind of arriving on the headlines. Social problems, cultural problems, health problems, even sort of problems of contamination of our food week after week, new crises. And it seemed to us as we entered this project that all of these problems have one cause, that our food system has, we have relinquished control of our food system. Our food comes from too far away, and we wanted to sort of take a sabbatical in getting that control back, in really knowing exactly where our food came from.
Well, talk about food coming from too far away. Of course, my listeners, our listeners on Forum are most educated on this subject, but they can learn a lot from your book. Indeed, in fact, Stephen Hoppe, you take us through the oily nature of food, so to speak, 1,500 miles on the average in terms of just a typical meal. All that means gasoline pollution. All that means global warming.
Well, it's interesting to see the attention to oil in the last couple of years has really exploded. It's not a question of how long we're going to have it or when it's going to collapse, but it's clear to everyone that we're facing a crisis here very soon. I calculated that if everyone ate one local meal a week that was organic, so raised in a manner that both eliminates the transportation and eliminates the petroleum in its production as much as we can, we'd save 1 million barrels of oil a week. Now, I wouldn't go so far to say as do it in a day, but that's about what we use on average for one meal in this country.
It's extraordinary to think in those terms. I mean, those are almost quantum terms. And you thought, Barbara Kingsolver, when you got this mission going? I mean, I think it was, Stephen, you had land in Virginia, family land, right, that you were going back to?
Yes. It wasn't family land, but I had been living there when Barbara and I met.
Yeah, we had planned for many years to move to this farm forever. This was we planned to live there for the rest of our lives, and it was a return to home for me. I grew up in southern Appalachia, so we wanted to move back.
But you grew up in Kentucky, though, right?
Yeah, just over the ridge, yeah. Basically. We, after living in Tucson, Arizona for 25 years, we moved back home for me, and so that the kids could know extended family. So we made the move for other reasons, but it seemed like a good time to formalize this commitment that we had planned for a long time to make, to grow a lot of our food and get the rest of it from farmers we knew.
You also said that you were living on borrowed water in terms of Arizona. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there were wonderful things about living in the West, and one of them is not water. There are fossil aquifers that the southwestern cities are using that are drying up. It's if we're facing the end of fuel and a lot of other environmental crises, the end of water is really staring us in the face.
Well, we've done whole shows on, of course, just water being privatized and all of that that's taking place. It's certainly disturbing.
So it was exciting for us to move back to a place where water falls from the sky.
Barbara writes about this, Stephen, as being something that gave her moral pleasure. I mean, did you feel the same, that enjoyment that almost comes from doing the right thing and feeling good about it?
Well, part of our companionship has been to garden and grow, not only food but ornamentals. Both of us discovered very early that we love to grow food, and this project really came out of two principal motives. One was that over time we grew more and more of our food, and it was a little bit, I won't say a contest, but we would sort of one-up ourselves every year. Could we grow this? What would this be like? Can we branch out in the number of varieties we could grow of melons, for example? Could we try and do little experiments of our own in no-till versus tilled areas, et cetera? And so this project sort of came out of that. The second motive, of course.
Family project.
Project, all of us, because all of the kids were involved. And Lily, our youngest, loves chickens, and we had chickens before the beginning of this project. I mean, it wasn't like we started out of thin air. But one of our principal motives was...
Excuse me, had you slaughtered chickens before this project?
We had, and before this we had mentored with some other people who were experienced doing that, and we have since mentored other people in how to do that. But one other motive I should mention is we set out to begin with to do a project that would get us on your show together, and here we are.
It's amazing to bring that miraculous thing into fruition. And this is a part of the growing, right?
This is the cultivating.
Speaking of which, you know, early on in the book, we find out, for example, that a lot of people don't know that potato has a plant part. A lot of people don't know where pineapples come from. I mean, there's an extraordinary kind of ignorance out there when it comes to food. It's almost wanton.
It's frankly bizarre for an animal not to know or care very much where its food comes from. For all of human history, the main job of humans has been to procure food, to grow it, to find it, to make it. And it's very odd that just in the last two generations we have walked away from the land, and our knowledge of food production fell away from us like dirt in a laundry soap commercial. It just
She can't avoid metaphors even when she doesn't write novels.
Sorry. It's just amazing to me as a biologist to watch this peculiar behavior, which we have come to accept as normal. We think it's normal to start our food quest each day with what do I want instead of what do I have. Instead of saying what's growing right now, what's in season, what's fresh, we say, it's January and I feel like oranges or tomatoes or whatever. We've become accustomed to having absolutely anything we want any day of the year from any place on earth. And the cost is that many of us have forgotten what seasonal means. And so if we want to return to eating more seasonally and more locally, the first step is just learning kind of the basic fundamentals of biology, how you know what is in season where you live. And that's a lot of what we wanted to do with this book in describing this seasonal year of food production for ourselves.
Got some great recipes, too.
Yeah. Camille wrote about nutrition and recipes. It's not by any means a how-to manual on getting you cranking out your own food. It's really more, in some ways, a Valentine to our urban readers. We want to help reacquaint people with the beauty of these processes and the secret natural histories of foods and how they grow and when to expect them. Because that's how, even if you're not growing them yourselves, it's how you know what to look for in your farmer's market, for example.
Well, there is this proselytizing a little bit subtextually, but there's also a kind of polemic here, I think, and it is that agribusiness has affected the way we eat and continues to affect the way we eat in ways that are continually invisible to us. At one point you say we're a nation with an eating disorder and we know it. And
well,
the eating disorder has a lot to do with agribusiness, doesn't it?
It does. This is the first time in history our kids, as a nation, our kids are the first in our history to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And that's because of what we're feeding them as a nation. It's because of our subsidy policies in this country so that our tax dollars subsidize junk food, not fruits and vegetables. I think that we're waking up to this and we're starting to care about this as an animal inevitably will when it realizes it's made a big mistake.
What are the biggest impediments that you found in making this year sabbatical work, Stephen?
Biggest impediments? Well, because we were doing this beforehand, there weren't huge impediments. In terms of what we felt like we needed in our diet, I think we didn't do what others have talked about doing, which was to draw a hard line in the ground and say we're going to do it within this region or that kind of thing. What we did is try and do it as close as we could. Of all of the things we ate, there were two things that were sort of lacking. One is seafood, because where we live is inland, about 400 miles. And so we were envious of the coastal locavores.
So there are people who couldn't do without sushi.
That's right.
Well, one interviewer said that.
And second was wheat. Now, we found wheat fairly close by to us within a couple hundred miles, but getting it milled was the problem, and we found a place that milled it, but they bleached it and enriched it, which we decided we didn't want to do, and so we ended up going north to Pennsylvania, about 300 miles away, to Amish communities where they grow spelt and whole wheat and rolled oats for breakfast oatmeal.
We basically did the best we could. We did not want to do something that others would look upon as heroic, because we didn't want people to say, wow, amazing, I could never do that. We wanted to do something that looked doable.
You wanted to be a paradigm.
Well,
exemplary.
We wanted a paradigm shift. We wanted to retrain ourselves in food thinking and to establish that a normalish American family, you know, with kids and working parents, could actually do this reasonably well. We actually used 100% of our vegetables came from our own county, 100% of our meats. A few other things we went farther afield for, but frankly, if we could keep 90% of our food dollars in our county, that's an incredible paradigm shift.
30% would be incredible.
Yeah, even 10%
would
be a
movement,
paradigm
and the slow
shift.
Food movement is really onto all this. And, right. And the idea that many people have of going to farmers markets and of growing their own food and going organic, I mean, it's all part of a general picture that we're seeing.
Yeah.
And there's definitely movement, especially here in Northern California. There's considerable.
Well, it started here and it has really radiated out. And it's been interesting on this book tour to see that in every city, this is an exploding notion that in Dallas, in New York,
in Alaska,
in North Carolina. Everyone does it differently because local eating means something different in every region, but everybody cares. And we had no idea when we started this project that we were going to release this book into a kind of a tidal wave of interest. We've never been trendy before, so we're
you're right in vogue.
We're trying to deal.
Well, in fact, there's some advice, a lot of advice in the course of this book. If you're looking for a paradigmatic shift, one of the things that you write about, Stephen, is the notion that you should go in a grocery store and maybe just speak up, ask where the produce is produced. You know, go to a restaurant and say, you know, where's your, and restaurants, of course, are becoming more cognizant and mindful. But
I read somewhere that if six people ask the manager of a grocery store the same question, then he or she considers it vital. And, I mean, it's an interesting point, because a lot of people don't go out of the routine, the sort of anonymous routine of going through the store or going to the restaurant or whatever, to ask something outside of the box. And that's a great thing to do, because as the demand grows, I think that gives opportunity for more farmers to get involved with this, for people to open the door for this to really grow into something that's going to make a difference in the way we use this country.
How many times has a cashier asked you, did you find everything you were looking for? And that's your opening to say, well, you know, I was looking for something local.
Or a waitress asking, you know, how is the food? Yeah. Well, where does it come from?
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
Restaurants and chefs and cooks have been shopping for decades, not on the basis of how things look, which is why they're stocked in the supermarket, but on the basis of how things taste. And they know that the best fruits and vegetables are picked when they're ripe rather than 3 weeks before, and then used within a day or two rather than 3 weeks later. We're getting shortchanged on both ends. And restaurants have been a driving force in making this really something that's in the forefront.
Well, you know, you're in Alice Waters country here, and you have prison projects where they're growing.
Absolutely.
You know, all that exciting stuff going on. Tell me, though, you know, there probably are some vegans out there and vegetarians who get concerned about the idea of, you know, raising your own animals for slaughter and using animals. And Barbara, you said something about this in terms of just, again, the lack of awareness and the ignorance where animal husbandry and animal slaughter is used for vegetable food.
Well, it's a nice fantasy that you could eat without killing anything. And far be it for me to, you know, urge anyone to divest of their fantasies, a little denial gets us all through. But every loaf of bread came from a field of wheat where the thresher took the heads off some bunnies. I'm really sorry that it, grain crops crowd out the habitats of foxes and bobolinks, and everything we eat has displaced or killed something. And so be it. So all of us look for our own ways to create a diet that we can live with. In our
Zorba diet?
That's right,
the Zorba diet.
Eat what's in season and glory in it. The whole meat question is so interesting because there are two very different ways of producing meat. The majority of meat in this country, virtually everything you buy in a grocery store or in a restaurant, unless it is specifically marked otherwise, is raised in a confined animal feeding operation, which is essentially the crammed wing-to-wing or shoulder-to-shoulder factory farms, metal windowless houses, and these operations function sort of as cities of poultry or cities of hogs, in which every unit of their food has to be manufactured, mixed, and shipped in from the outside, and then the waste is very concentrated, and that's an environmental problem. This is not a system I feel any affection for, and so I don't buy food from that system. But pasture finishing, having animals on pasture, raising heirloom heritage animals from the same animals that our grandparents raised, that are specifically adapted for foraging and reproducing and living outdoors, and that finish well on grass. That's another system. These animals have good lives by their standards. They sort of operate with the dignity of their species, and they exist solely to leave a legacy on our tables. That's the reason that humans bred these animals, and the reason the only reason they still exist in the world is that some people are interested in eating them. So we participate in this this second type of meat production, and we feel that it's an honest business to raise these animals from start to finish.
You read Michael Pollan's book, I take it.
Absolutely. Oh, Omnivore's Dilemma is a great book. I really recommend it.
What do you think about what he says about the organic industry? Because you, particularly Stephen, seem to be a strong advocate of organic farming and organic food, and organic industry seems to be part of the agribusiness as far as Michael Pollan is concerned and some of their methods and so forth.
Well, Michael Pollan sort of opened a discussion of sort of the purity of organic, and people who prefer organic food have entered into this discussion in our country as well. What we mean by organic, the federal government now oversees that. The corporate interests try and undermine what the criteria are for organic, and so we're moving a little bit more in the direction of small diversified farms where, for example, Barbara just talked about the wastes from the hog lots. In a small farm that's done in a way that mimics an ecosystem, the manure from the handful of animals that they have serves through compost to fertilize the garden.
It's like the one Michael writes about that's in Virginia.
Exactly.
Right, and there are many
yeah,
farms
many
like
this
that use animals and vegetables and together in a small ecosystem that works very well, that's very sustainable. It's a sustainable industry on a small scale. The large go ahead.
And so part of his point is that organic as a strict criteria can be corrupted. It can be corrupted in more than one way, but local cannot. You can't move things a long distance and still call them local. And I think to diversify our diets, the local farming, if people prefer it and support it, has to exist by creating these small, very diverse, very integrative organic farms. I mean, that's really the only way that this is going to work.
If you just joined us, by the way, we're talking to Stephen L. Hoppe and Barbara Kingsolver, co-authors with Camille Kingsolver of Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. And this is a book, as I said, I just want to mention this again, that has some recipes in it as well. It's a good lesson in what has happened to the food industry. Stephen writes about pesticides. That's not necessarily something that we can be heartened by in terms of the battle on that front. But then there's all kinds of interesting history in this book as well. That's Scotsman with the Urban Gardens. In fact, let me do this. Let me open up. I found that fascinating. But let me open up the phone lines because I want to hear from you, our listeners, just about the whole idea of spending a year eating locally, growing your own food, the idea that you can really make a significant impact on the environment, particularly if this becomes a kind of meme or takes on a viral quality to it and spreads. And I suppose that's maybe
sounds insidious.
There is nothing insidious about this. Maybe there are some of you who feel that there is. Join us if you do. Join us, in fact, if you have some opinions or some thoughts about this, or if you would like to join us in conversation. Our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or on the Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, and we welcome your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And Barbara and Stephen will be at Book Passage later this afternoon at 1 o'clock and at the Wells Fargo Center in Santa Rosa tonight at 8, though it's unclear whether or not that's a sold-out event. But if you'd like to talk with us, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Barbara Kingsolver and her co-author and husband, Stephen Hoppe, discussing their new book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, which tells the story of how their family was changed by a year of deliberately eating only locally produced food. And we're going to go right to your phone calls, and we begin, Holly, with you. Good morning.
Oh, great. Can you hear me?
Hear you fine.
Great. Thank you for another excellent program, as usual. I wanted to let the listeners know about the reauthorization of the Federal Farm Bill, which is coming up very soon. To give you an idea of how big the Federal Farm Bill is, in the last 5 years of the bill, that it allowed $20 billion of spending for conservation on public lands. So it's one of the biggest funders for conservation, among other things, on public lands in the country. And there's a preliminary bill, which is like a mini draft bill, that's already been introduced in the House called the Healthy Farms, Foods, and Fuels Act of 2006. And it would, among other things, link producers with consumers through farmers markets and farm-to-cafeteria initiatives, provide assistance to low-income and elderly consumers to be able to consume fresh and local food, and it would expand an existing popular fruit and vegetable snack program to more schools. So I just thought this would be something that your listeners would be interested in, and if so, might want to write to their local representatives, like in the Bay Area, Barbara Lee, Pete Stark, and Nancy Pelosi. The three of them aren't on this yet, to encourage them to make sure this makes it through to the end of the Federal Farm Bill. And people can get more information from this from the California Department of Food and Agriculture website, or from Environmental Defense's website.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Holly. And I don't know if Barbara or Stephen want to comment on the Federal Farm Bill.
Sure. I do. I'm so glad you called, Holly, to bring this up. It's really important to add that it's not a done deal. Our legislators really need to hear from us about how important this is. That it's the conservation and the parts of the Farm Bill that promote diversified agriculture are still minuscule compared with the billions of dollars that we are paying from our taxes to subsidize commodity crops, which, and bless their hearts, the corn growers and the wheat growers of the Midwest are doing their best, and they're not the ones who are making huge profits. But the great majority of our tax subsidies through the Farm Bill support corn that is corn and soybeans that are going to be turned into high fructose corn syrup and grain for feedlot burgers. So that's,
this is part of your indictment of agribusiness.
Yeah, this is there's a reason why junk food in our country is cheap and organic food is expensive. It's not because it's easier to produce. It's because we're paying to make it that way. That's why our kids' school lunches look the way they do, with tater tots and mystery meat. It's because we're paying for a system that reinforces the foods that our Surgeon General says we should eat less of. So,
Stephen Hobb.
We set up a website for this book, animalvegetablemiracle.com or .org, either one. And one of the pages on there is a page that talks about the Farm Bill and gives some links to organizations that are trying to get people involved in this, and that's a place to go.
And we'll go to some more calls, and we go to Berkeley. Corey, good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Great. Thank you for doing this program. I am a nursing mom at this point, so the food issues are a big deal to me. And one of the things that drives me crazy is when I go to the store and I see that there's, 25 kinds of oranges I can choose from, and I live in an area where oranges grow locally, and it bothers me a lot to, be having that kind of choice. It links for me to a quality of life that I think we've lost, like in traveling experiences, when you can actually try local flavor, that's a unique experience, and you learn something about a culture and a community when the food is more local. So that's another kind of loss that I feel like we're really suffering.
It's a big plus, I mean, when you can do that, because it enhances community.
It's wonderful when you can, and it's a real loss when the food becomes, a huge franchise where the food is the same all the way along in your travels. And also it ties into the whole local medicine, that the actual quality of the food has ingredients that you need when you eat the food in your own area. So I'm aware of those things, and I also just wanted to give a plug to the local farm stand, the Berkeley Youth Alternatives, in my area, does a nice promotion where they actually try to encourage people in low-income neighborhoods to be eating more local organic food. And it's just really great to see them giving out samples of, you know, strawberries or apples to the kids that are playing in the park, and see kids that are, you know, you definitely usually into the junk food, grabbing 10 friends and saying, you got to come over here, you got to try this. You know, so I really value that quality of life, and I'm looking at a possible move, and I realize how special it is to live somewhere where there is still food grown and food that makes sense.
Well, thank you, Corey, for
bringing up these issues today. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate that and your call. You're going to say something, Barbara Kingsolver?
Oh, the great news is that there are increasing local options everywhere in the country. You do have it made here. You have a lot of great food grown in this region. But you're not alone. It's all over the country. The local food economies are tougher in the urban areas
and, you know, the cold weather states and all that.
Actually,
100 years ago, they did it.
They did it in cold areas, and they did it in urban areas.
And there's a revival of both of those going on, not only in this country, but all over the planet.
Diversified, organic, sustainable farms on the outskirts of cities are the fastest growing sector of our agricultural economy right now. These farms are getting foods into cities. And also, I love that you mentioned that it drives you a little crazy to have the choices that you do have. We talk a lot about absence of choices, but when you do have choices, when you can read the label. If you have apples that come from your state and apples that come from New Zealand, it's an easy pick.
Or from Oregon, if you're here.
But the good news is that people are starting to think again about the sources of their provenance, mm-hmm. and to make these choices. And those of us who do have some choices can exercise them, strengthen our local food sheds, and broaden the availability of these options into other neighborhoods, to other people that have at present fewer choices.
Stephen Hopp.
At the risk of using the same answer for all of the callers, our website, Animal Vegetable Miracle, has a page that's devoted to finding local food. And on there are included some other links to their sort of local food search engines, including one, localharvest.org, which I believe is housed in the Bay but works for the entire country.
On we go to more of our callers, and join us. Suze, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to first acknowledge Barbara because I think she is phenomenal. I've read everything you've ever written, and I look forward to anything that you're going to write in the future. I'm always amazed by you.
Well, this is her first non-narrative work.
First
narrative nonfiction. In fact, you wrote that book about the strike a number of years ago, Cornell Press published, right?
I did. That was actually my very first book. It was a nonfiction book, but it's called An Oral History, I guess, officially. So this is my first full-length work of narrative nonfiction.
Every bit is amazing, just different.
Thank you.
Just different.
Really...
It took me a little bit to wrap my mind about it because I'm ready for your humor, which I love in your books, and it's different. It's different. It's more serious. But
come out tonight if you want to laugh until you fall out of your seat. When you get to the turkey sex parts, it's pretty funny.
Okay, that's good. That's good because I love that about your books. Is I can be crying one minute and laughing the next, and that's so important to me in life.
This book is by no means serious. It's a serious topic, but I knew as we approached this subject, I had to make it a page turner so that it had to have all the same elements as a novel. It has to have characters and plot and an arc, and it has to make you laugh, and it has to make you cry at the end. So I gave it my best.
Full disclosure on that note, I've written a book, and it's coming out in September, and you are in it. And at one point you said, I guarantee you a loss of a night's sleep. And that was your sense of what you needed to do as a novelist, right?
that's my charter.
Let me thank Suze for the call, and on we go to more of your calls. Raul, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for this program. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, I'm not a very frequent shopper in the big chain supermarkets, but I do go occasionally, and what I notice is in the middle of winter, you have tomatoes from Holland. in California. Now, it boggles my mind when I think of the sort of transportation issues alone of bringing tomatoes from Holland to California. You know, and I think that people are, in a sense, we're given choices that we never had to make in the past, because who would have bought to even thought of getting tomatoes from Holland?
We're with you there.
Yeah,
we are.
Sometimes I think when my kids are the age that I am now, having this conversation with them, when they say, well, you knew you were at peak oil, you knew about global warming, you were running out of cheap fossil fuels, and what did you do with the last drops you had? You pushed fresh tomatoes from Holland so that you could eat them in January, and they didn't even taste that good because they had spent their entire lives in a boxcar. What were you thinking? I'd like to tell them, you know, I knew that was crazy. I wanted to do something different, and I did.
A couple of, speaking about tomatoes, here's Marv who says, is it true that all tomatoes in the store in the U.S. are picked green and then enclosed in a room of ethylene gas to turn them red?
Oh, it's a very large percentage of them. I think I read somewhere between 70 and 85%, something like that. Huge percentage.
This is why you find your farmer's market. Buy them from a farmer.
And all the micronutrients that come into play just before they ripen are not present in tomatoes.
They're not there.
Some troubling questions raised by some listeners that I want you to tackle here. Here's Jenna, for example, who says, I'm a huge fan of all Barbara Kingsolver's writing. I'm very excited about the new book. Haven't read it yet. Got it for my birthday last week. I have a question that always comes up when I seek to live in an alternative way from the crowd. When you don't own land and are on a very small budget, how can you make these alternative choices? Local food is expensive. Are there some money-saving ideas I haven't thought of? And then here's another listener who writes, the idea of eating locally resonates strongly with us. We live in Hollister. We're surrounded by ranches and farms. Eating locally helps keep small producers on the land. We subscribe to an organic CSA, and he goes on, essentially, grass-fed beef and the like. Mm-hmm. Then says, but really, isn't eating locally a bourgeois indulgence? We're happy to pay a premium for local organic food, but it's not something everyone can afford. You get into that cost thing here.
I am so glad you asked that question. When we did our year of local eating, because we formalized this experiment, we kept really careful books. We wrote down everything that we paid for food in the farmer's market, in the grocery store. We also kept track of the price of what we harvested had we bought it elsewhere. We discovered when we did the tally at the end that our year of eating locally and organically and splendidly, in our opinion, cost us on average 50 cents per person per meal. So there goes that myth. Now, it's true that we did raise a lot of our own food, but if you factor back in the cost, had we paid for that food at the farmer's market, it would have been closer to $1 per person per meal. The main cost-saving technique is to cook. When you start with whole ingredients, even if they are organic, local whole ingredients that cost a few cents or even a dollar or so more than in the supermarket, you're still starting with whole ingredients that can, a handful of fresh vegetables can be made into a meal fairly simply. Wholesome, simple recipes are the answer, and it takes some training to learn how to do this if it's not something you already do. But I think when people go into sticker shock over organic or local, they're often looking at barcodes. They're looking at stuff that someone else has prepared. So preparing food yourself is a huge cost-saving measure. Also, really looking for what's in season and abundant and stocking up on it is always the cheapest way to go. Now, it's true that our farmers market is a proletarian farmers market. We live in a community of farmers. I know that in cities, the costs can be higher, but if you keep looking, there are options. There are CSAs that give you the option of going out to the farm to do your own picking to reduce the cost by half in some cases. There are plenty of options.
So my producer reminds me that those like Kevin, who eat all organic, call Whole Foods Whole Paycheck. And he also tells me, by the way, that there are tickets available to the Santa Rosa event.
Oh, okay.
So
okay,
that's important to know. You'll be there tonight at 8 o'clock. Now, here's a you want another tough question. You handled that with usual grace and aplomb. And ease, I might add, but this one maybe not so much ease, because I know it gets right to the heart of something that's always been of profound concern to you. This is from Theodora, who says, I live and work in El Salvador, and throughout Central America, a lot of people earn their livelihoods, albeit barely working the land. I'm wondering how your guests would respond to concerns that local production would take jobs away from the very poor people throughout the world that feed their own families by sending produce, cattle, etc., to the United States. Clearly, these producers do not benefit economically from the current system. The few owners of land and production companies do, but it is still how they survive.
Do you want to take that, or shall I?
Well, it's a complicated question,
yeah,
and it's
is.
Different in different countries. But one of the problems that we're seeing when we look at the international scene is that the producers down there, the growers, whether it's vegetables or meat, are trying to fit what they're growing into the criteria of whoever is selling it, whether it's the W chain, I think you know who I'm talking about, who have criteria about the exact diameter and exact color of the tomatoes that they're growing. And what we have read, haven't been down there to see it in Guatemala, but what we have read is that these people are getting taken advantage of because they're getting sort of underpaid. Because, frankly, that's why the tomatoes come from Holland, is because they can get them cheaper there. And on the economy of scale is taking advantage of the marketer's idea that we're going to pay 10 cents less for food. And it's in Guatemala or wherever these are grown, there are less stringent environmental regulations, so they
can
get
DDT,
away using DDT, which you can't use here.
Yeah.
And there are no labor unions.
And there's no labor unions, so that they become in essence slaves to these not necessarily the companies, but to the process of growing. We think that for them, they'd be better off to protect both their land and their future, to work on feeding themselves.
Well, we're on point here with the next caller, I think, aren't we, Kristen? Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I was curious how you handled the question of coffee, which I don't think can be obtained locally, but in my mind would be hard to give up.
Oh, yes. In fact, it would have been for us a deal breaker. Yeah, and it's interesting because it does relate to the previous call, and that is for regions where they can produce something that we cannot, but we feel like is important, if not essential. And coffee is a good example. Wine would be another example, because wine becomes very international these days. And frankly, we don't need it, of course, but we love it. Olive oil, well, I mean, olive oil for a good chef is they would claim, a necessity. But coffee can be grown in Central America in a way that is friendly to the environment, shade-grown or bird-friendly coffee. It can be done in ways where the small growers combine into a cooperative. And
there's a whole sustainable coffee society.
Absolutely. Fair trade organizations will certify how they're grown so that you can obtain them. And coffee, because it's a relatively small amount of what we consume each day, as is olive oil, as is hopefully wine, can be obtained in this fashion, which does help the growers down there.
Yeah, fair.
Barbara Kingsover.
If you're getting something through fair trade, you can be sure that your farmer is being fairly compensated, and that the habitat where this crop is grown is being protected. And in fact, shade-grown coffee, fair trade, is better for the environment than just about anything else that could be grown there. To return a little bit to the previous question of, are we turning our backs on the third world farmers by improving our local, strengthening our local food economies, it's really important to remember that the people who are getting the profits from these foods that we get from the developing world are not the pickers. They're not the growers. They are the marketers and the
shippers
and the oil companies.
Wow.
The labor is the least well paid component, and often these big tracts of land that are taken over for things like soybeans in Brazil, for example, are displacing subsistence agriculture, burning rainforest, crowding out local communities of food producers who would have been feeding themselves had these agribusinesses not come into, before these agribusinesses came into clear land for banana production, for example, or soybeans or other crops that are being sold on the other side of the world. So encouraging local food production in every corner of the world and enabling,
this is a global movement.
Yeah, enabling farmers to feed their own communities is turning our backs on no one. It's really it's the best way for people to survive.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking with Barbara Kingsolver and Stephen Hoppe about their new book, Animal Vegetable Miracle: A Year of Food Life, and they spent the year essentially deliberately eating locally produced food, and this is the story. We're about on a pledge break here. Can you just give one really good recipe, and then we'll come back to our callers?
Oh, here's use the answer again. Our website, Animal Vegetable Miracle, has every single recipe in the book downloadable, and we did that so that you could print them out. They have wonderful illustrations from our good friend Richard Hauser, and you can put them on the counter, and, you know, if you spill sauce on them.
Two things that are in season right now that are seasonal right now are one for greens and fresh local eggs, which is called Eggs in a Nest. That's one of our family inventions.
Is it green eggs and ham?
Oh, yeah, no. There's no ham in it. But that's one of our family favorites. And another, which is adapted from Deborah Madison, is asparagus and morel bread pudding, which is the best thing I've ever eaten, I think in my life.
Bring this up to me, Barbara, before lunch. Actually, it's also before a pledge break here. And as you know, we're holding our pledge drive, and we hope that you will become involved and pledge. Just a few minutes of our broadcast time for a local audience, but if you're listening to us on Sirius Satellite, we'll remain with you through the program. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio, and I'm Michael Krasny. And we do go to more calls. We go to Jeff. Good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Did you say it was animalvegetableminerals.com?
No, it's Animal Vegetable Miracle. See, that's a problem because all of us as kids, or so many of us, played that game, Animal Vegetable Mineral.
Well, that's the point.
Oh, sure.
All of my titles have a little bit of cognitive dissonance. I mean, people tell me about, I loved Pigs in a Blanket.
Do a search for Kingsolver.
Yeah, then you'll find it.
Well, you know, speaking of spot searches and titles of your books, I just have to read you. And excuse me for just a minute, Jeff, but this is an email from a listener named Glenn who says, "You're hands down my favorite author. I love everything you've ever written and can't wait to read your new book. I actually scan through the local bookstores, new fiction and new nonfiction, periodically looking to see what else you might have written. Please write faster."
Okay, then. Well,
we would if we weren't on book tour.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
So I just moved to San Francisco, and I've got a very small backyard, but I wanted to grow vegetables. But
terrific.
I'm concerned about, I've heard lead levels in the soil and other toxins in a city environment. What can I do?
You can get your soil tested.
Oh, sure. If you're concerned about your own particular soil, or I'm trying to interpret your question, you're concerned about what's in the air. Is that the concern?
Yeah. You can take a
lead in the soil.
You can take a soil sample and find out. Probably an online search would tell you where locally you can send this to a lab and get back a good reading on what cadmium or lead or other heavy metals might be in your soil. And you might be happily surprised. We've done testing on our farm because it's an old farm, and we were concerned that there might be DDT or other unpleasant surprises.
But
it's amazing that organic production, organically amended soil is very resilient. And so if you really start now composting and putting a lot of amendments into your soil, you'll be happy with it. And your air quality, if you can protect it from being by an open street, you know, if you can have a board fence or something that prevents emissions from passing cars from directly falling on the leaves of your tomato plants, that's good. Also, you know, you wash everything really well, but I wouldn't worry about it. It's whatever you grow in your backyard is probably going to be healthier than just about anything you by
Stephen
Hawking. I hadn't thought of that.
You can get it in the skillet or on the stove or chopped up and eaten pretty darn quickly if it's in your backyard. What I wanted to suggest is I'm sure there's a huge urban gardening movement here, and they would be a great resource.
Santa Barbara has one of the best in the whole world.
See, there
right?
you go.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know where you are exactly.
And they'll give you
And again, our website has a Finding Local Food, and it has CSA Finding links on there as well.
You could have just brought a little audio tape that our website, every time you hit it, right?
Yeah, that's yeah. right. That would have been easier. Or I could have just sent it. I wouldn't have had to make this trip.
Hey, thank you, Jeff, for the call. And let me get another caller on here. And that's you, John. Good morning. John, are you there?
I'm here. I was fixing my breakfast with
locally grown. Locally grown breakfast, huh?
Yeah. Cherries from J&J Farms.
Great. Cherries are coming in Virginia very soon, too.
I do a few things that I you know when I first heard the interview with Barb and her husband talking about this, it rang a lot of bells because I ride my bike with front and rear panniers from our house about 1 mile to the Alameda Farmers Market on Tuesday,
good.
And so that saves a couple of cold starts most of the year. If I buy more food than I can put in the four front and rear panniers. There's too much for the two of us to eat, so it works out really well.
Oh, that's a great way to gauge.
A new take on portion control.
Yeah, exactly.
Also good for the waistline.
What's really been good is I gave up my addiction to the $12 bags of kettle corn that they have.
Oh,
it was really tough to do.
That would take a whole pan here.
Well, I had a two-bag.
That could be a deal-breaker for some other people, yeah.
So, you know, but it's a good thing there's that kind of white stuff instead of the other kind on the streets.
Oh, that's true.
But that works really well, and it makes me feel good all week. And the relationships I have with people I talk to every week are a lot of fun. Talking to people at the market about not only their drive up and back, but how their kids are doing when they bring their kids to help with the market, or talking to my friend Corey, who just called us on Friday because she had the last asparagus of the season and wouldn't make it for Tuesday. And we went up to her house and got 4 pounds, and that was our last celebratory
wow.
bunch.
John,
and
that's going to have to be the last comment. You hear the music coming up. It means we're at the end of the program, but I'm so glad you called, and thank you all who called in this program, and thank you especially to our two guests, Barbara Kingsolver and Stephen Hopp. Again, their title, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life, and the website, Stephen.
AnimalVegetableMiracle.com.
Or .org, you said.
That's right.
That
works
too.
Fine.
And again, there'll be a book passage at 1 this evening in Santa Rosa at the Wells Fargo Center. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.